My next guest is bioengineer Tor Bezier, whose high-tech medical imaging research aims to find new ways to help people with movement and mobility problems and disorders. He's an associate professor at the University of Auckland's Bioengineering Institute and has been at the forefront of biomechanical research of the musculoskeletal system, including injury and disease. Prior to that, he established Stanford University's Human Performance Laboratory and was a researcher at Stanford's Orthopaedics Department. Tor and his team have just received $1 million in funding from EMBI for developing computational modelling of movement disorders, particularly for stroke and cerebral palsy. His research has implications for orthopaedic care, including the diagnosis and treatment of injury and disease. Good morning, Tor.
Morena, Lynn.
Good, so much to talk about here. But let's start with a definition. I like to do this. Machine learning. We're going to be talking about this. What is machine learning?
Right, well, it's a bit of a buzzword. You hear it often, I think, and particularly now in the healthcare context. And it's used in conjunction with another term which a lot of people have probably heard about, which is AI or artificial intelligence. And the general idea about AI is it's really trying to incorporate human intelligence into a machine. And then so machine learning is kind of a subset of AI, which is trying to empower computer systems with the ability to learn. And that's kind of interesting in the context of generating lots of data. So we're talking about big data now, the idea that you can get lots and lots of information from wearable sensors and different technologies. And so these are really just computer algorithms that are designed to look at patterns of information, and then we can train these computer algorithms to try and predict certain outcomes. And so that's kind of the general context here, is that we're collecting lots of data, lots of information, and then using these computer systems to try and predict what kind of things we would see in those data that might otherwise be difficult to see or interpret.
I think I've read and watched too much sci-fi when it comes to AI.
Right.
So I've seen the potential dark side. Do you have to be wary when you're exploring the possibilities of AI? Clearly there are lots of positives, but are there potential issues with this too?
Yes, there are. And this has been highlighted by some recent work looking at how machine learning can potentially, particularly in the healthcare context, which is where I work, where it can lead to or mislead you to the wrong conclusion. And so one of the challenges, I think, is for us is to look at what patterns you're trying to predict and see in the data that you collect and whether they have a grounding in, say, the laws of physics or physiology. And I think it's all too easy to see that these types of approaches can predict an outcome without really knowing what's underneath. So it's kind of a black box approach. And so to kind of make this a bit more clear, maybe I can give you some examples. So for example, the world of radiology is one which is potentially being transformed by AI or machine learning, where you could teach a computer to quickly go through a set of MR images or CT scan images and try and predict if there's an abnormal image, for example. And to do this, you really need to start off by having a training set, we call typically a training set, where a human has informed the computer and said, look, this is something that's abnormal, and you try and then teach the computer, or the computer learns itself about what is abnormal in that image. And then after a period of time, if you give it enough data, you hope that the computer can do a good enough job at predicting what's normal or abnormal. And in that example, you could imagine if the person who's training the computer to say what is abnormal, if they have some sort of bias or if they incorrectly train that data set, you're then training that model to predict something that may not be true. And we call this a bias. This is you're introducing a bias into the data set to predict something that may not be the case. And this is kind of understandable when you look under the hood at what's going on, and the computer algorithm is just looking for patterns in data and patterns that might exist. And in terms of healthcare, you could potentially train a system to look at these relationships And the system may know nothing about human physiology or the laws of physics. It's just looking for patterns and recognizing these patterns. And this has been highlighted recently in some research articles from the States that have shown that you could train a data set and it can do quite well at predicting information in that data set. But if you give it data from the real world, from other examples, that model may not actually give you a good prediction from real world data. So this is an issue really with reproducibility. If you want to have a model that's informing healthcare, for example, you'd like that model to be reproducible and use that model for lots of different contexts. And if you train it on a limited data set, for example, it might work well for that data set, but maybe not be generalized to the population. So that's one example of where, you know, the machine learning approach has issues potentially, because you have to train it on some data that you think you want to actually get an experience.
Are these this bias you're talking about, is this insurmountable?
Well, we have a slightly different approach, I think, to some of the other groups around the world. So when I say we, I mean my fellow colleagues at the Auckland Bioengineering Institute. And for decades, we've been building computational models, mathematical representations of the human body. And the idea is that we can represent the laws of physics and physiology with mathematical models. And so with the onset of these new techniques and methods, we have lots more data now that we can put into our models. But if our models are grounded on what we know in terms of the laws of physics and physiology, then we can do predictions that have certain meaning rather than just associations between large data. And so what we're doing that's a little bit different is using machine learning in the context of a physiology or physics-based representation. And I think that kind of sets us apart from some of the other groups around the world who are using machine learning or AI-type methods to do predictions purely based on associations of large data sets.
See, the other thing, of course, we come back to instinct. And you mentioned before that, of course, people are, you know, can make mistakes. But what about human instinct, seeing something unusual and the gut saying, you know, there's just something here I don't like the look of, something very subtle. Will machines ever be able to do that, do you think?
Well, I think there's some good cases where machine learning kind of methods can be used to look at things that the human eye maybe can't even pick up. And radiology, again, is a good example of this, where you can give a computer many, you know, hundreds or thousands of images, and the computer can go through and look at differences or associations, and it has potentially a better ability to pick up things that are slightly abnormal or unusual. The challenge is for us to decide if those unusual or abnormal things actually are really meaningful. And I think this is a challenge that's been presented to radiology in the past few decades. As medical imaging has improved, you start to look inside the human body and start to see all of these variations that exist. And it's natural to, you know, from a clinical perspective, to ask, are these normal? Are these kind of within the realms of a normal variation, or are these abnormal things that we should be concerned about? And so we're still kind of coming to terms with this, because a lot of these new, relatively new imaging modalities are now being used with lots more data, and we can have a better idea of what's normal and what's abnormal. Just one other thing on quality and safety, an interesting anecdote from a very early paper that was looking at kind of AI approaches was done in the US military in the early 90s, and it's kind of a classic paper that people kind of talk about. And the idea was whether you could, these researchers were trying to develop a machine learning approach to use vision to distinguish between images where some images have these armored vehicles or tanks hidden in the trees, and these other images were just kind of an empty forest. And so they input all these images of tanks and empty forests. And after the initial kind of run of this model, it looked like it was quite successful on one set of images. It could distinguish those images where you could see this tank in the trees and those that could not. But then the next set of images, it was about 50-50, so pretty much a coin toss about whether it could predict it. And afterwards, when they looked at the results of this, it turns out that the positive training images that were given, where the tanks were in the bushes, were all taken on a sunny day, and the other images were all taken on a cloudy day. So these people had successfully created a machine learning method to determine whether it was a sunny or a cloudy day, regardless of whether there was a tank in the trees. And I think this is kind of a good example of where if you input a training set that maybe doesn't have the results or something that you're really looking for, if it's a limited data set, then the outcome you get is going to be quite different than what you expect.
And it takes time to train a computer, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. I mean, we're talking about large data sets here now. You know, medical imaging data sets can be gigabytes in size, so you could quickly fill up a hard disk with lots of medical images. So, yes, it takes time, and this is one of the challenges of the field, is trying to create these models with tremendously large data sets. But, of course, computational power is still increasing, and this is one reason why we can see a burgeoning of these methods, is the computational power is increasing, as well as the ability to run models on these large data sets. So, you know, we can do things that we previously couldn't think possible because of computational speed.
I heard a story about how long it took to train a computer to distinguish between a dog and a cat.
Yeah. So there's some, you know, this is so easy for us to tell. Like, this is a cat, this is a dog. You know, the 2-year-old can tell us that. But it's actually not so easy to train a computer to say this is a dog and this is a cat. You know, they both have 4 legs, they're kind of fluffy, they've got some ears and a tail. And you say to a computer, look, here are, you know, 1,000 images of a dog and 1,000 images of a cat, and sometimes it gets it wrong, whereas a human would always be able to identify that. And so kind of a few years back now, there were some researchers who have started to look at really the way that the human brain processes images. And this is another subset of AI, and it's called deep learning, which, again, you may have heard about. It's kind of another buzzword. But it's really, deep learning is trying to really, it gets its inspiration from the way the brain processes information. And these new methods have been found to be far superior at identifying things that you or I might find, you know, completely easy to identify, you know, between a dog and a cat. So now the computers are learning in a way that maybe mimics the human brain, and they're getting much better at doing that.
With the emphasis going into machine learning within medicine, Tor, is this about efficiency and ultimately affordability? Ultimately, though, is it also going to replace people, or will it always be there to assist rather than to replace? Because whenever you hear about AI, the next thing you hear is about job losses.
Sure. Well, in the context of the work we do, particularly in orthopedics and in this new research we're doing with neurological disorders, we're designing tools really to assist the clinician in making decisions. And, you know, with the neurological disorders as an example, a patient who comes into a clinic who's received a stroke, that, you know, presents with lots of different features in terms of movement characteristics and disorders. And so you would naturally do a qualitative assessment of that individual to see, you know, what kind of disorders exist here, and you try and then determine what a treatment strategy might be. And so in that context, what we're doing is trying to use lots of data to characterize those patients and say, look, these patients maybe exist in subgroup, and that subgroup might be defined based on where the lesion has occurred in the brain, for example, or the type of disorder that's manifest in the stroke. And by doing so, you could then give the clinician a better indication of, well, if you see these type of patterns, maybe this is a better treatment strategy. And right now, you know, it's kind of a bit of a shotgun approach in a way, that you try one thing, then try another thing. So we're trying to really just assist the clinician rather than take over. You know, it's, as you said, the conversation typically goes to, well, if we can train a computer to do it and the computer does a better job of the human, why do we need the human? And so in areas such as radiology, which we've been talking a little bit about, I think there's potential for humans to do a better job than a human eye, for sure. But there's risk associated with that, because the human might take into account other factors that the machine doesn't know. And so these other factors are, of course, critical in making a firm diagnosis and providing some support then and a treatment strategy.
I'm talking to bioengineer Tor Berzier. Now, let's have a look at this $1 million from MB. We've touched on this, but I'd like to learn more about this computational modelling that you've got and your interest in movement disorders also. Where does that stem from?
So we've been, for several decades now, myself and my colleagues have been working on trying to make mathematical representations of the human body. And our interest is in the musculoskeletal system. So we're talking the bones, the muscles, the joints. And fundamentally, questions like how we move. And you'd think after decades of research, we'd kind of understand that. By now, that seems like a pretty basic thing. You know, how do we move? What are the forces? And how do those forces transmit through our body into the different tissues? But there's lots of interesting questions that remain unanswered. And particularly with a neurological disorder, of course, as I've mentioned, that a stroke, for example, manifests itself in different ways, and you see different movement patterns and adaptations following this. So, you know, you see an adaptation in the way that you can control your muscles. And in order then to walk and move and get around, you have to do things slightly differently than you did before. And so the human brain is then trying to take control of a system that it suddenly now is perturbed by this disorder. And so our interest then is in creating models that can quantify these movement disorders. So that covers a spectrum of measuring movement to begin with. So if you want to walk in a clinic and try and analyze someone's movement patterns, their walking gait, for example, you might put wearable sensors on that person so that you can measure the motions and potentially measure forces and other things that are relevant to that movement. And then you want to interpret those sensors, the information you get from sensors, with a model that represents the human body. And this model then you might want to characterize the geometry of that person. So their size, their mass, the shape of their bones might be important. And traditionally, you know, it's taken a very, very long time to actually make a model that accurately represents the human body. And this is one of the challenges we're going to address with this funding from MBE. And it's a key challenge that people all around the world are trying to face here, is the ability to generate these computational models. And it might, you know, previously it might take a year, for example, to make one model of one person. And we're talking about really personalized medicine here. So you could imagine taking an MR scan of someone and going through that MRI and saying, well, here are the bones, here are the muscles. That's a painstaking process, but it's necessary if we really want to understand on a personalized level how this person moves, what are the forces that are responsible for that movement, and how is this person's movement being altered by this disorder. And so that's kind of one of the key challenges that we're going to address with this research.
So what are you hoping will come from that? Will it be treatment plans? Will it be earlier identification? Because I know that's extremely important for these movement disorders too. I mean, how could it change the face of healthcare in this area?
Right. So once you've got a model, it becomes quite useful then in terms of doing certain predictions or looking at potential interventions. And as I said, creating that model is a challenge to begin with. So what we started this research some years ago, and we created what's called the Musculoskeletal Atlas Project, or MAP for short, the MAP project. And the idea was to create an atlas of the human body. And so we've worked with the Victorian Institute of Forensic Medicine in Melbourne, Victoria, where they have post-mortem CTs of tens of thousands of individuals. And we have small subsets of those, so only 1,000 adults and several hundred children. And the idea is that we go through those medical images and we make models of these populations. And so when it comes to creating these models, what we can do is we can say, look, we've already got populations of models. Let's find someone who's a close match to this population. And rather than have a medical image of or an MRI scan of an entire person, you could say you could take a subset of information from that person. You could say take a tape measure and you could measure their limb lengths and with their mass, maybe their sex and their height. You could predict with quite high accuracy what the geometry and shape of their muscles and bones are. And so that project then, the outcome of that will be a way to rapidly generate a model. So in the future, you might turn up to a clinic and you might have, say, a couple of measurements taken from you. That could go into our atlas, and the atlas, in a matter of minutes, could spit out a computational model which has a fairly accurate representation of your muscles and bones and your geometry. And then the challenge is, well, then what information do we have to animate this model? And this is where the movement data comes in. So we have wearable sensors we can place on patients. We can also measure muscle activity with another type of sensor as well. And I'm working with colleagues at AUT who are looking at biosensors. Andrew Lowe at AUT is looking at a new class of biosensors that could be easily integrated into, say, wearable garments. So you could imagine putting on some shorts, and the shorts have sensors that measure the muscle activity underlying your movement. And this information then goes into these models, and we can look at what are your strategies for movement and how have these strategies been altered perhaps by your neurological condition.
Exciting times in your field, aren't they?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, we've been working for decades on building these models, and a lot of work goes into validating the models as well, and that's an important point. In order to convince our clinical colleagues that these models could be used to help them assist make a diagnosis or a treatment plan in the clinic, we have to convince them that the models that we're developing can be predictive of something that happens in the real world. And this gets back to this idea that we discussed with machine learning. You know, if you train a model on one data set, that's all well and good, and it can predict well within that data set. But we want to generalize that model so it can predict for different situations and outcomes. And ultimately, what we'd like to do is do virtual clinical trials here. So the idea is you create a model of a patient, and virtually you would like to test out, well, what if we did this intervention with this patient? What if we gave this patient a brace that might do change the load in their knee joint? What if we give this patient an intervention like a strength training intervention? We strengthen the hip joint muscles. How might that influence how the person moves? And these predictive simulations might then be used ultimately to decide what's the best intervention or treatment strategy for a patient. But we're not quite there yet. We still have a little ways to go to be able to show that our models have this predictive capability. But, you know, with these new methods, with our fundamental models that, again, characterize the laws of physics and physiology, as well as the wearable sensors and the ability to collect these data, I think we're getting close. And so, yeah, I think it's an exciting time to be involved in the area.
You're also, Tor, an advocate that it's never too late to exercise, and subjecting our bones to stress would be a really good thing, whatever our age.
Yeah, sure. So when I was at Stanford, I was fortunate enough to be involved in a lab with some colleagues who'd done a lot of work and research on the fundamental relationship between mechanical forces and the tissues in our body. And so this kind of area of study is called mechanobiology, and it's kind of like biomechanics, but inverse, really. And it's really understanding how does the biology respond to its mechanical environment. And all of the tissues in our body do respond to their mechanical environment. And the challenge is trying to understand how this is the case. And so bone is a living tissue, as is cartilage and muscles and tendon, and they adapt to our mechanical environment. So I've been influenced by this group, and it's kind of interesting if you look at things like joint health, bone and joint health, because the Surgeon General report in the United States for decades has proposed that there's certain types of exercise that are good for people. And some of those exercises include, you know, walking. Some of the exercises include cycling and swimming. But if you look at some of these exercises, cycling and swimming in particular, they involve quite low loads at the joint and low impact loads. And so swimming, for example, you know, you don't have the same effect of gravity. And swimming might be good for some muscle tone and cardiovascular fitness, but it's actually not good for your bones because you're not experiencing large impact loads. And so this kind of message, I think, is important, particularly in the context of our aging demographic, our increasingly overweight demographic, and our increasingly inactive demographic. And we're seeing this with our children now. We're seeing rising obesity, we're seeing inactivity, and we're seeing the correlates of those later on in terms of health. And so the work that my colleagues at Stanford have done, and we've done some of this work as well, trying to understand the relationship between the mechanical environment and how the tissue adapts to its mechanical environment, clearly shows that what you do during growth and adolescence has an impact on your musculoskeletal system for the rest of your life. And that's kind of a scary thought for people who are already past their age of skeletal maturity. So if you're beyond the age of 20, you might think, well, gee, this, I've kind of gone past it now. There's little I can do to kind of alter the course of nature here because the structure and form of my musculoskeletal system is already there. And so there's, of course, there's stuff we can do to maintain the health of our musculoskeletal system, but really this is a public health message that we should be having our children physically active during growth and adolescence, because that really dictates in some ways whether or not you'll go on to get osteoarthritis or osteoporosis, these kind of diseases of the skeleton later in life.
For older people, though, as you're saying, it's not too late to make a difference. But I mean, how much is too much when it comes to putting our bones under stress? Because we can often be less risk averse, or you know, more risk averse as we get older.
Yeah, so these are interesting questions that we try and resolve, because they're fundamental to understanding, as you suggest, you know, how much is enough and how much is too much. And it turns out that bones and other tissues in the body respond quite a lot to the magnitude or the size of loads and forces in the body, more so than, say, the number of cycles of loads in the body. And this is kind of an interesting concept, because what it suggests is that you could experience a short bout of intense activity which might give quite a large stimulus to the bone cells that are sitting within the bone. And that stimulus is enough for the bone to be happy. And it says, look, I've experienced the stimulus, I'm all good. You could go swimming for 2 hours, for example, and receive very low load stimulus, but you know, over a long period of time, and get almost the same response as if you do a very short, intense bout of skipping for, say, you know, a minute. And so this is kind of interesting, because then you think, well, okay, if we really want to modulate or change the mechanical properties of our tissue, how do we do it? We could either go and exercise for 2 hours at a certain intensity, or we could do high-intensity exercise for a very short period of time and essentially give the bone the same stimulus. And these are kind of things that we're trying to come to terms with in terms of, exercise prescription, for example. This is relevant for athletes who have been injured, or this is relevant for patients who have had a joint replacement, and you're trying to say to the patient, okay, you've had a knee joint replacement, what kind of exercise is good for you? How much is enough? How much is too much? And so we're active in these areas. We're using wearable sensors. We're using our computational models to try and measure in the real world what are the kind of loads and load exposures on the musculoskeletal system, and then how might these loads influence the mechanical properties of the tissue or the health of the tissue longer term? Because, you know, these are really important questions if we want to maintain healthy tissues throughout life.
Thank you so much for your time this morning. Lots to think about there. Talking to bioengineer Dr. Tor Berzier. If you wanted to get in touch, text 2101, email 9 to noon at rnz.co.nz.